Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Natalie Schnall. I represent the defendant appellant James Whitler. My registration number is 39138. I would like to address the first issue in the brief, and that is the trial court's erroneous denial of Mr. Whitler's motion to suppress his statements to police. As a brief summary of the facts, in this case, Mr. Whitler was arrested and placed in a police car. An officer read him his Miranda rights and asked if Mr. Whitler would like to speak with him, having these rights in mind. The trial court found that Mr. Whitler invoked his right to silence and indicated that he did not. There's no dispute on this point. Shortly thereafter, a detective arrived on the scene and inquired the officer whether Mr. Whitler had been Mirandized. The officer unequivocally told the detective that Mr. Whitler did not want to speak with him and that he had been Mirandized. Nevertheless, the detective went over to Mr. Whitler and asked him, if I can get you out of here, get you over to the station, get you some water, get you out of those handcuffs, would you be willing to discuss with me what happened here? Mr. Whitler then agreed, and he was then transported to the police station and promptly interrogated. Under these circumstances, the police did not scrupulously honor Mr. Whitler's indication of his right to silence, and therefore Mr. Whitler's statements should have been inadmissible.
Well, Mr. Whitler made, and I apologize for mispronouncing his name, Mr. Whitler did not make any inculpatory statements to the detective at the scene. He just said he'd be willing to talk.
That's right.
And the detective did not ask him any substantive questions at the scene.
Not at that time.
And about 2 hours elapsed between his arrest and his subsequent interrogation at the station.
The testimony is a little conflicting as to how much time actually elapsed. It ranges from anywhere from 70 minutes to 90 minutes, and the trial court found that it was under 2 hours.
Okay.
It was only the amount of time that it took to transport Mr. Whitler to the station and process him. There was no additional waiting time.
Thank you.
In that delay. So once a suspect, such as Mr. Whitler, invokes his right to remain silent, the police officers must scrupulously honor the assertion of his right in order to comply with the constitutional protections. And additional circumstances must justify resumption of police questioning after a defendant has invoked his right to silence. We look at four guiding factors that are based on Michigan versus Mosley to determine whether police officers did scrupulously honor a defendant's indication of his right. Under the four factors, the first being whether the police immediately ceased interrogation, whether they resumed questioning only after a passage of a significant period of time, whether the police gave fresh Miranda warnings prior to the second interrogation, and whether the subject of the two interrogations were the same or different.
Can the counsel be both given a second set of Miranda warnings once he was at the station house, correct?
He was, yes. The Detective Coleman asked him if he remembered the Miranda warnings that he had been given at the scene. Mr. Whitler said that it was a blur and he was therefore re-Mirandized. At that point, though, I would argue that it was too late, really, because the violation occurred at the scene when Mr. Whitler invoked his right to silence and was then promptly readdressed by the detective.
Michelle, let me ask you about that, because there are cases going either way on the time lapse.
Mm-hmm.
We know that interrogation ceased. We know that there were random warnings given. So let's focus at the scene. How would you characterize what the lieutenant said to the defendant in this case? Was it an interrogation? Does it need to be an interrogation? What is the significance of what the lieutenant said, and how should it be characterized?
So what he said was aimed at convincing Mr. Whitler to waive his right and speak with him. You know, he asked him whether, you know, if I can make you more comfortable, would you be willing to talk to me? The only purpose in approaching Mr. Whitler and asking him this question was to get him to agree to speak with him. That was really his intent. And because that was his intent, that suggests that, you know, he didn't have the intention to honor Mr. Whitler's right to silence.
Okay, so was that an interrogation, and does it need to be an interrogation? to support your argument.
I don't think it needs to be an interrogation. And I don't know necessarily whether that question was an interrogation, but I don't think it so much matters because the interrogation that happened in this case directly resulted from that question. They're tied together. The only reason he was interrogated when he was because he had agreed to do so at the scene. So really it flows from the questioning that happened at the scene.
But he could have changed his mind once he got to the station, right? Even though I agreed to talk to you, I don't want to talk to you now.
Right, he could have changed his mind, and of course that is why these cases sort of contemplate, you know, what are all, you have to look sort of at the totality of the circumstances and what are all the circumstances that go towards preserving this indication of a right. When can you when can police resume questioning of a defendant? And, you know, that's why it has to be sort of a significant passage of time to sort of distinguish what's happening.
So given that there was nothing damaging said in that brief encounter, why doesn't, you know, the passage of 70 to 90 minutes and then a new Miranda warning, why doesn't that cure any problem here?
It's because, like I was saying, it's because the interrogation that happened at the station is directly caused by the question at the scene. You know, the only reason there's any delay in this case is because of the amount of time it took to transport him. If he had lived 5 minutes away from the police station, we would have had a 20, 30-minute delay in this case instead of an hour and a half. And so I think because the question at the scene resulted in the interrogation, that even the later Miranda warning is too late at that point, because the violation and the failure to scrupulously honor his right to silence, the indication of his right to silence has already happened at that point.
So you're saying that the lieutenant's question of would you be willing to talk to me if I made you more comfortable is itself a Miranda violation?
Yes.
How do you distinguish that case from, you know, the small talk cases where the transport officer says, well, how are you feeling, or something like that?
Well, if he had simply asked, how are you feeling, that would be very different from, you're feeling poorly, would you like to talk to me if I can make you feel better? There's really, the purpose of this question is to initiate a longer conversation and interrogation, is to get Mr. Whitler to speak with them about the crime that just occurred.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
As I was saying again, the delay in this case is really only incidental. It was just the necessary delay in terms of taking him to the police station.
Why is it only incidental? I mean, aren't we looking at the amount of time that lapsed and whether the environment or circumstances changed?
Right, and looking at the factors as a whole, this isn't the type of case where there was a break in the interrogation and officers allowed a significant amount of time to elapse before they reapproached the defendant. In this case, it seems as though if there hadn't been a long drive to the police station, there would not have been a delay because the interrogation room was already set up and waiting and ready to go when Mr. Whitler arrived at the station. So there was no intent by the officers to allow for a delay. It just merely happened because of the circumstances. And again, I think what we should be looking at is more what happened at the scene rather than the transport and what then would happen later at the interrogation.
Well, let me ask you about later, after what happened at the scene. So you said the interrogation room was set up ready to go. Was there any testimony that distinguished the actions the police took at the point he arrived at the station from usually booking someone in to how they booked him in or after the booking process, is there a place that a defendant would go ordinarily as opposed to this defendant? Was there any testimony?
There was testimony that he was taken directly to the interrogation room. He wasn't taken to any other types of booking room or any other, like a soft room that they sometimes have defendants wait in. He was taken straight to the interrogation room. That was the only testimony on that point. I also want to point out that there were no additional circumstances here that justified Detective Coleman's conversation with Mr. Whitler at the scene. Sergeant Thane that testified that there was no request by Mr. Whitler for an officer to come over and come back to him to speak with him. He simply remained in the back of the police car. So there is no indication that Mr. Whitler had changed his mind about speaking with anyone in the 10 minutes that had elapsed between the two officers who approached him. And I just want to point out that these statements were obviously very prejudicial, and the state cannot prove that the admission of these statements was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In any case, a confession by a defendant is extremely damaging testimony, extremely damaging evidence. It undermined his defense in terms of self-defense and also the lesser offenses that were submitted to the jury. Prosecution repeatedly quoted from the interrogation and closing argument and urged the jury repeatedly to watch the video. And in fact, the jurors did request to watch the video during deliberations, which indicates that it was of significance to them. Notably, the last thing that the jurors heard before they went to deliberate was a clip from this interrogation video in which Mr. Whitler admitted that if the police had not arrived when they did, that he would have killed his children, which was directly contrary to his defense on this point. The court has no further questions. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I will limit my argument to the motion to suppress unless the court has any questions on the other issues raised in the briefs. To begin, the trial court did not err in denying the defendant's motion to suppress. The police did scrupulously honor the defendant's invocation of his right to remain silent. As defense counsel pointed out, Mosley outlines several factors that the court is to consider in determining whether or not the defendant's invocation of his right was scrupulously honored. Again, this list is not exhausted, and no single factor is conclusive. Now, the first factor, of course, is whether the police immediately ceased interrogation upon the defendant's invocation of his right. Here, that's exactly what happened. The officer asked the defendant if he wished to speak to him. He shook his head no. The officer closed the door and left. No further questions were asked of the defendant.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. At that point, there was an immediate cessation.
There was.
Then that officer went and talked to a lieutenant who said, did you Mirandize him? Did he invoke his Miranda rights? Yes, he doesn't want to talk. And then the lieutenant went back to him and said, if I do these things for you, will you talk? So is that a cessation of interrogation?
It is, because the officer's statement was not interrogation at that point. Interrogation is words or action that are designed to elicit an incriminating response. Asking the defendant whether or not he would be willing to speak with the police at a later time following certain circumstances isn't designed to elicit an incriminating response at all. And at the point that the defendant said yes, the officer again immediately closed the door and left the defendant alone. He didn't say, oh, well, how about talking to me right now? Can I ask you a few questions right now? He immediately left. He honored the defendant's invocation of his right to remain silent, and then a significant period of time passed before the second interrogation occurred. And again, I don't think it's relevant why the amount of time occurred here, whether or not it was because there was a lengthy drive to the station, or whether it's because the police left the defendant alone in a room. The fact remains that the defendant received the benefit of at least 90 minutes, possibly close to 2 hours, before this second interrogation occurred. And again, it's undisputed that the defendant received another additional advisement of his Miranda rights at the time, The officer said to him, "I'd like to speak to you. I'd like to hear your side of the story if you'd like to talk to me." And he gave him a written advisement. They went over it. The defendant went line by line through the advisement, signed the advisement, and stated that he was willing to talk to the officers. So in this case, we do have an immediate honoring of the defendant's invocation of his right to remain silent. No questions were asked at the scene. Officer Coleman's statement asking if the defendant would talk to him at a later date was not interrogation. It was not designed to elicit an incriminating response.
Counsel, but even if the questioning at the scene, once he invoked, even if that questioning did not in fact generate damaging information, wasn't it intended to and didn't it in fact yield a commitment to talk to the police?
It did not. And the defendant was certainly able at a later time to say, "No, I changed my mind. I don't want to talk to you at this point. I've had an hour and a half to think about it. No, I'm not willing to speak to you." But we do have to look at whether or not the defendant or the officer's statement to the defendant at the scene was an interrogation. We have to look at whether or not his question was designed to elicit an incriminating response. And his question was simply, "Would you be willing to speak to me?" The answer to that is simply yes or no, neither one of which is incriminating.
All right, so regardless of whether we would characterize that as an interrogation, going back to looking at, was this scrupulously honoring a defendant's right to remain silent? We have a defendant who said, "No, I don't want to talk." And then an officer said, "Well, if we do these things for you, will you talk?" So how would you characterize that? And is that honoring a right to remain silent? And if not, or if so, what?
I do think that it is, and I think it's also important to take in the totality of the circumstances here. When the defendant originally invoked his right to remain silent, the officer immediately closed the car door and left. He returned approximately 5 minutes later before Officer Coleman approached the defendant. And at that time, he gave the defendant water, he loosened his handcuffs, he made sure he was comfortable in the back of the car. So this isn't a situation where the police were in some way trying to make the defendant agree to speak to them by making him uncomfortable and promising to only give him these things that he wanted if he agreed to talk to them. The defendant had already received water, he had been made comfortable to the extent possible in the back of a police car, his handcuffs had been adjusted. So this isn't a situation where the police were holding back and refusing to accommodate the defendant unless he agreed to speak with them.
All right. And were those accommodations made before or after the offer? If we give you water, if we loosen your handcuffs?
Before.
So the statement was made before, "If I do these things for you," and then they went ahead?
No.
No. Okay.
Officer Fayen, the original officer that spoke with the defendant, he testified at the suppression hearing that after the defendant invoked his right to silence, he returned to the car about 5 minutes later, gave the defendant water himself, loosened the handcuffs, and then he then talked to Officer Coleman, who approached the defendant about 10 minutes after the original invocation. So those things had already been provided to the defendant at the point in time where Officer Coleman said, "If we do these things, okay, would you then be willing to speak to us?"
Did the lieutenant, I guess that's Coleman.
Yes.
I mean, at the suppression hearing, did he explain why he put that question to the defendant, knowing that the defendant had already refused to talk?
He didn't explain why he had asked the question, simply that he knew who the defendant was. They had some prior contact. So he opened the car door, said hello to the defendant, and asked him if he'd be willing to speak to him later. There wasn't any testimony regarding his motive for doing so.
I mean, wouldn't a fair inference be his motive was contrary to the defendant's assertion of his right not to speak to the police?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Again, all that's required is that the interrogation immediately ceased upon invocation of the right to remain silent, and that's exactly what happens here. The fact that Coleman then approached the defendant and asked him if he'd be willing to talk to him at some later time does nothing to not scrupulously honor the invocation of his rights in this case. And again, that statement and that question to the defendant was not designed to elicit an incriminating response. He didn't continue to ask him any questions at the scene. He immediately closed the door, again honoring his right to remain silent, and didn't speak to him for at least 90 minutes.
And Coleman isn't the one that drove him to the police station?
He did not. He did not transport the defendant, and once the defendant arrived at the station, he was involved for at least 30 minutes in the collection of evidence. He changed clothes, he was given water and a bathroom break. So again, he received all of those things prior to Coleman again approaching him at the station and asking him if he would like to speak to him. Does the court have any further questions? I would also like to point out that in this case, I do believe that any error here would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. There was overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt in this case. The prosecution presented the testimony both of the defendant's wife, his two children, who both witnessed the attack and murder of the process server in this case, as well as being victims themselves. There was the testimony again of the defendant's wife. There was the testimony of the officers who arrived on the scene and found the defendant still attacking his children and refusing to cease even when the police arrived. There's testimony, of course, from the forensic pathologist talking about the cause of death here, and there were multiple pictures presented to the jury showing the state that the defendant's home was in, the blood spatter evidence. So there was definitely overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt in this case.
Did the wife witness the attack on the process server?
She was present initially when the defendant first hit the process server with the baseball bat for the first time. She was there for that. She then screamed and ran out of the house. The defendant swung at her and hit her arm on her way out the door. And she then left the scene and went to the neighbor's house to call 911.
Thank you.
With regard to the incidents against the children, the defendant's statements that he would have killed them had the police not arrived, your opposing counsel said that this shows that it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and I just wanted to hear your response to that.
Again, I think there was, that testimony was cumulative of other testimony. We had the testimony of the victim's son, who was basically in a headlock at the time that the police arrived. He heard the police come in. He heard them telling the defendant to stop, and the defendant didn't, and in fact tightened his grip around his son's neck. So I think it can be inferred from that the defendant had no intention of stopping, and that had the police not actually tasered the defendant to get him to let go, that he would have continued. So I think that's something that the jury could have found from all of the other evidence presented in this case, despite his statements.
Okay.
If the court has no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the defendant's convictions.
I'd like to just first address your question that you just last asked, Judge Lichtenstein. In closing argument, the prosecutor points to the interrogation video and says, with respect to Mr. Whitler tightening his grip, says, they tased him, he consciously tightened, he didn't say anything on his video after they tased him about involuntary muscle spasms that caused him to tighten. No, he says, I didn't let go, I continued. So, again, using the interrogation to show Mr. Whitler's intent here to obtain a conviction on the attempted first-degree murder of his children. I'd also like to point out that this is a case where, unlike in the cases cited in the briefs, this is a case where law enforcement persisted in repeated efforts to make Mr. Whitler change his mind. In having Detective Coleman go back to Mr. Whitler in the car when he knew that Mr. Whitler had invoked his right, there was really no justifiable reason for him to approach him. I'd also just like to point out that Mr. Whitler should not have had to re-invoke his right to silence. There was some discussion as to whether, he could have re-invoked his right to silence at any point. He shouldn't have had to do that because he had already done so, and that was not respected. Additionally, the fact that he had been approached right after he had invoked his right to silence indicated that the officers were not likely to respect that right and would have dissuaded him from invoking it again. That comes from case law as well as cited in the briefs. If there are no further questions, I would ask the court to reverse trial court's ruling and remand the case for a new trial.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused, and we will issue a written opinion in due course. That is